Thank you very much, Bill. Your reference to Jefferson seeking DuPont de Nemours' advice for the curriculum for his proposed university in Virginia leads me to refer to an earlier attempt by Jefferson to establish a university in Virginia. He proposed to George Washington that the United States invite and move the whole faculty of the University of Geneva to establish their university in Richmond. They had been attacked by the French Revolutionary armies and were displaced, and he thought not only to give them refuge but to create a whole fully existing university faculty right in the middle of I wouldn't say downtown Richmond, because just Richmond had just been founded and sort of didn't really have a downtown, but anyway, to establish them there. And Washington meditated on this and thought that the United States was not going to benefit a great deal from a faculty that only spoke French and didn't speak English, and the students wouldn't really be educated in that context. So that first attempt by Jefferson had to be put aside. Eric von Kunert-Lodin last night in his brilliant presentation referred to the value of monarchy and one of the leading liberals of the 19th century, Charles Dunoyer, at the conclusion of his life, called for the restoration of monarchy in France as the way to ensure a liberal society. Professor von Kunert-Lodin taught at Georgetown University some years before I was a student there, and when his great book, Liberty or Equality, was published, I read it, and I then was a student of Professor Tibor Kerekes at Georgetown, and as a consequence of that book and the work of Mises and Hayek, I was inspired to be the founder of the first chapter of the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, which was established at Georgetown in 1953. Tibor Kerekes had been the military aide-de-camp of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand and was at his side at the time of the Archduke and his wife's assassination in Sarajevo in June 1914 by the Serbian secret police, which ignited the Great War, First World War, which was the cause of all of our problems right down to the present day, starting with the rise of communism, the response to that with the rise of fascism, etc., etc. We can date the end of the liberal era in 1914 with the beginning of the First World War, and we're still living with the consequences of that. We've seen that in Bosnia, we've seen it today in Kosovo, and we will see it in other countries. We see it in other parts of the world. So we are talking about the foundation of a society that is very much under attack, that's been under attack, and the defense of which has been a lot of our, something to which we've all dedicated a great deal of our efforts. Paul Johnson wrote a very important book, which unfortunately did not get the attention it deserved. It was a book on the birth of the modern era. By that he meant the period after the end of Napoleon's First Empire, the Restoration period, a period of immense intellectual activity. Questions raised there, which I feel still have never been adequately answered, but the beginning of addressing them came at that time. It's a book you might want to look at and meditate on. In the background to this era following the end of this First Empire was exactly the period that was presented by Bill Campbell. That is, the starting in the middle of the 18th century, and a period in which the Enlightenment had arisen, the Enlightenment in which Voltaire and Montesquieu had gone to England, discovered England, discovered the rule of law, discovered a very adequate political system based on checks and balances. England, to all intents and purposes, was a republic. Charles Dunoyer refers to that and says later, well, we can have a monarchy in France because it's the same as England, and England, for all intents and purposes, is a republic. That means it has none of the bad effects of monarchy and all of the good effects of it. This strong recommendation of an English model came under attack by the later French philosophers, such as Rousseau, who attacked England, England's commercial society, and the system of the rule of law which it had. And when the American Revolution occurred, and the American revolutionaries opted, for the most part, for continuity, and indeed, the American Revolution was a defense of that England which was then in the process of being transformed, of being changed. This new bureaucratic England was exactly what Burke was constantly attacking, and therefore why he supported the American revolutionaries. The continuity that the Americans put into the constitutions that succeeded their colonial charters looked to this new French philosophical viewpoint as backward, medieval. And indeed it was medieval. They were absolutely right on that, and that's why England and America have always been successful. They've been medieval constitutional systems. And the French began to attack that. And one reason was that France had suffered a great defeat in the Seven Years' War. They felt England had been too greedy. That is, the French had lost every battle, and the English therefore gained lots of territories, including Canada, from England, from France. So the result was that a great struggle occurred, in great debate. And John Adams wrote his defenses of the American constitutions in order to try and make a strong statement in France to the French that he knew why the American constitutions and the British constitution on which they were modeled were the right way to go. But this Anglophobia had created among even the best minds in France a suspicion of England, a suspicion of the institutions of England and those institutions that the Americans not only inherited but preserved. So that when the French Revolution occurred and new orders of politics were created, the French rejected both the American and English models and went off on their own models, which were totally unsuccessful and indeed destructive. In that context, in that struggle, the debate in ideas, a new journal was created, the Decade Philosophique. The person behind it, Clavier, was an important banker. He was a minister of finance under the Girondins when they were expelled by the Jacobins. He and the other Girondins were guillotined. But his assistant became the editor of this journal, and that was Jean-Baptiste Say. And Say continued to edit this journal for about 10 years. And in that journal, you have the beginnings of a great deal of the ideas of the classical liberals. After the fall of Robespierre and the Jacobins, the people whose ideas were being reflected in this by this very young Jean-Baptiste Say were able to emerge from hiding, from exile, even from prison. Destutt de Tracy had been awaiting the guillotine in the prison. He was supposed to be executed the day after the Thermidor, after Robespierre was executed. He was spared. Same happened with the family of Tocqueville, happened to be later on the execution list and therefore were spared by the execution of Robespierre. These people emerged and began to present and discuss their ideas. Still, a lot of these leftover, I would say, bad ideas mixed in with the good ideas coming from Montesquieu. But one thing they had fresh and that they took without dilution was the contribution of Adam Smith. Adam Smith's work was very much influenced by the work of Turgot, was very much similar to the work of Dupont de Nemours and to Condorcet. Destutt de Tracy, who had been a military officer, had been the aide-de-camp of Lafayette, had turned to philosophy, especially in the context of being in the prison, and continued then to write on these issues. As, for example, Bill mentioned, he wrote a strong criticism of Montesquieu, reflecting this, what I would consider, bad trend in French thinking at the time. But it was a strong enough view, well argued, that Jefferson translated it into English and had it published in America. Now, these thinkers were able to increase their writing during the period of the empire. Say himself and Constant were exiled by Napoleon, but they could continue to write from their distance. They were Say himself became set up a manufacturing of cotton spinning in Picardy, and Constant was able to go off to Switzerland and to Germany. So it was a kind of light form of repression. People were exiled, not imprisoned. So a great deal of writing was continuing under in this period, leading to the end of the empire in 1815 and the blossoming of all this pent-up thinking. Jean-Baptiste Say's first edition of his book around 1803 was then revised and republished in 1814 when he returned to Paris after the first fall of Napoleon. And a number of people in a new generation had come forward, like Charles Comte and Charles Dunoyer, who began to study these writings. And they, looking back a few years later, said three books totally exploded in there before their eyes. One was Jean-Baptiste Say's Treatise on Political Economy. The understanding of political economy, the role of economics, was so clear, so important, and there was the expansion of economic activity after the end of the First Empire. This became very important. Second was the work of Constant, especially his book on conquest and his understanding of the role of liberty, the contrast between liberty in the ancient and the modern world, and the importance of constitutionalism, that the Constitution has to be absolute, You cannot have flexibility in the Constitution. You can't have leeway. You can't, because the one who is going to take advantage of flexibility and leeway is always going to be the head of the administration, the king, chief executive, dictator, whatever the label. It will always be to the advantage of the head if the Constitution is not absolutely enforced. And third was a history of France by Comte de Montpensier. 2 weeks ago, I was attending a Socratic seminar in Indianapolis of the Liberty Fund on the topic of liberty and commercial cities in early modern France, and the important text we were reading on French history referred back to Montpensier as the source for this important historian's view of France, because this aristocrat had been part of the exile from France during the period of the Jacobins. When Napoleon was thinking of moving from being first consul to being emperor, he wanted to bring back the nobles. He wanted to mix in. He had began to create his own nobility. All his marshals and generals were being made dukes and counts. The heads of administrations were given titles. But he wanted to bring back the old nobility to mix it in and create some sort of high society in his court. And Montpensier was brought back, and Napoleon said, write a history of France which shows how what I'm doing is what all the kings of France have done in the past. So he wrote it, and it didn't satisfy Napoleon, so it wasn't published until after Napoleon fell in 1814. But in there, he described how it was the ability of the governments to co-opt the new, more productive part of society, rather than allowing them to challenge and create a totally productive society, but rather to incorporate it in and siphon off productivity into the regular system of looting, which was the norm for these governments. So this, again, this what was considered a moderate royalist history was very influential on the classical liberals, that the role of history to them became very central. And I may make one footnote which refers to the Mount Pelerin Society that Eric von Knut-Ludin mentioned last night. At the in April 1997 50th anniversary meeting, which was held in Mount Pelerin, I gave a paper on the importance of history for classical liberal thinking. All the papers were based on the 1947 papers. There had been a paper on the importance of history by Veronica Wedgwood, a leading historian of the English Civil War. And one of the unfortunate effects of the divisions in the society that were also referred to was that after that there was a kind of dominance by University of Chicago, especially George Stigler, and therefore subjects like history and philosophy did not come into discussion. And so we've suffered for 30 some odd years from, for instance, in the Mount Pelerin Society, from a lack of attention to history, and history, both European and American history in particular, that is, histories that explain why we are where we are and where we might go, are things that we need to be continuing to discuss, including in our society. Now, as a consequence of these readings, this new, all sorts of new ideas were coming on the scene in the period after 1815. A more, we might say, total classical liberal viewpoint was developed, something based not merely on economics. Economics, like physics, is a foundation. You have to have that. But beyond that are the other issues, history to explain where we've come from, where we are, and where we might go, and constitutionalism, how the role of the Constitution is the precondition for having the successful implementation of economic ideas. If there is no protection of rights, if there's no protection of property, then all of the good ideas about economics, about growth, are meaningless because those do not result in a just distribution, but go to the government officials and bureaucrats and those receiving the bribes of the special interests. So it's this totality of viewpoint which was very central and which came out of this explosion of freedom of press, very limited under a lot of attack, but much more so than under Napoleon's First Empire. So I would recommend that, first of all, you go back and look at Paul Johnson's book on the birth of the modern. There are a lot of ideas for future research and publication, and in particular the centrality of these classical liberals, who of whom there are a lot more and much involved, for instance, the late 19th century peace societies, peace congresses, role of international law and international relations in world affairs. Thank you very much.
I'd like you to note the fact that the Philadelphia Society does have a website, and we have a lot of papers from past meetings on there. We have tributes to many of our illustrious people, like Don Lipset, whom I discussed in my earlier introduction. Also to Henry Regnery, Russell Kirk, Gerhard Niemeyer. The only person for whom we have a sort of a whole separate page with many papers established is for Leonard Liggio. And I took the liberty of taking two or three of his papers that he's given over many years and putting them on the website so you can go download them there and read them to your heart's content. They're absolutely marvelous. Now I would like to set the stage a little bit for introducing Bruce